Thanks for coming, everybody. My name is Mark Lugel. As Mark said, I'm Vice President of the University of St. Thomas, and I'd like to issue an open invitation if anyone wants to come and visit me at St. Thomas in January. You're more than welcome. It's here where I pause for a beat and say that I'm at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota, not in the Virgin Islands. But you're still welcome. We have a great panel for you this morning. All of us have written books about the Mississippi River, and between the four of us, we've got the river covered from the headwaters. We're pretty close to the headwaters at Lake Itasca down to here. And it's an exciting day here at the zoo. And I'd like to thank a couple people as we get started. First of all, our hosts at the zoo. We could give them a brief round of applause for hosting us today. And I'd also like to give a special thank you to folks I don't think we've had a chance to thank yet, and that's the booksellers. These guys in the back here have been working hard since Wednesday. Have taken your books. And they got books for sale today as well, and they've been just outstanding to work with. So outstanding, as a matter of fact, that Oliver had not seen a copy of his new book until he walked in the door this morning. They had the first copies. So he said he's not allowed to have it yet. In any event, let me quickly introduce our panelists. The format will be that they'll each talk for 12 to 15 minutes, and then we'll open it up to just a general discussion, a conversation. So I will introduce them. And just by way of further sort of introduction, it doesn't come to a surprise to anyone in this room, a room full of journalists, and those that work with journalists, that a place like the Mississippi River inspires writers and has inspired authors. Twain is the first one we think of, and there's actually a federal law that says if you have a conference on the Mississippi River, you actually have to mention Twain, so I've gotten that out of the way. But even authors like Thoreau, who's more well known for writing about the Northeast, spent time on the Mississippi River and wrote about it. And then you've got Audubon as well. And then, of course, you've got Campanella and Houck and Klein. All the greats have written about the Mississippi River, including three that we have sitting here. So starting with my farthest downstream point, let me introduce the authors.
It's actually upstream.
Upstream.
Downstream.
Yes. Richard Campanella is a geographer at Tulane University at the School of Architecture. He's the author of seven books. And Lincoln in New Orleans is one we wanted to mention in particular. Bienville's Dilemma, a geography of New Orleans, a book on Bourbon Street. The importance of Dr. Campanella was illustrated to me on Thursday during our tours. I went on the Great Lakes of Louisiana tour, and at least three times during the tour, one of the tour scientists said, pointed to a Campanella map and said, well, let's see what Campanella has to say about this particular region or this particular zone or this particular issue. So I thought that was a compliment to your work there. To his right, a little farther than downstream, Oliver Houck, professor of law, also at Tulane. A brand new book, Downstream Toward Home, which his publisher said is not a memoir, but it is. And Oliver is an environmental and natural resources law expert, former federal prosecutor in Washington, D.C., National Wildlife Federation General Counsel, and I look forward to reading the new book very much. And then Christine Klein, nearest me, law professor at the University of Florida, endowed chair of law, also natural resources law expert, has taught at Michigan State and Denver and CU Boulder, is that right?
University of Denver.
And is author of a book called Mississippi River Tragedies, with Sandra Zellmer, and I was particularly interested in Christine's CV when I saw a title of one of her papers called Beating a Dead Mouse. So I'm interested to hear what that exactly was about. In any event, I thought we'd start with Richard and kind of work our way this way. So let's hear it for Richard Campanella, everybody.
Thanks very much for the introduction and the and for coming out this morning. Most of my research on the has been on the physical, urban, and human geography of New Orleans and how the Mississippi has affected and influenced that. You are experiencing that right now. You are on what passes for higher ground in New Orleans on account of the depositional capacity of the Mississippi River. You're about 7 or 8 feet above sea level because you're only less than half a mile from the river, and this is where the river historically would have deposited the lion's share of its coarse sediments. The very fact, if you looked at a map as you came uptown this morning, that Tulane, Loyola, Audubon Park, and the zoo form this elongated wedge is a secondary byproduct of the Mississippi River because the French subdivided the high ground into elongated French long lots, and the city, as the city spread, it filled in into that surveying system. So you know, patterns, intra-urban spatial patterns. What I'd like to talk about today is a different track that I took in what to date is one of my favorite research projects I've ever undertaken. And it stems from a childhood curiosity I had about Abraham Lincoln's two trips down the Mississippi River. You may know that he came down to New Orleans in 1828 and 1831. And so instead of looking at intra-urban patterns to see how New Orleans and the river fit into these larger economic and hydrological systems. And I want to bring specific attention to the flatboat trade that existed. So very briefly, after the Louisiana Purchase, as Americans are coming over the Cumberland Gap down the Ohio River and settling in what was then the West, and the far West being the Rockies, they started cutting down forests, growing corn, growing wheat, raising hogs, to the point that they could feed their own families or they would have a frontier exchange economy. But it got to the point that there were enough surpluses that what they really need to do was export that, convert it to cash, and start an economy where they could buy outside industrialized goods. So you needed a port where you could exchange these frontier commodities into cash. You couldn't well go up against the current in the days before steamboats and over the Appalachians. Very little commodities went through the Great Lakes and out the St. Lawrence. The most effective way was to sail down with the current, transship at New Orleans, sell at New Orleans. And so from the early 1800s almost to the Civil War, you had this system of young Westerners, almost as a rite of passage, young males in anywhere from 16 to 25 years old, demonstrating their responsibility by building a flatboat, taking their families' extra produce down the Mississippi, selling them in New Orleans. They sailed with the current. You did not need fuel. You just needed to steer, which was no easy task. And then land in New Orleans and then successfully get the highest price, disassemble and sell the flatboat. It was now useless. And then either come back via a keelboat and take horses and or walk back along the Natchez Trace, or with the advent of the steamboat, take a steamboat back. And that's what Lincoln did. So once steamboats came onto the picture in the 18-teens, for the next 40 or 50 years, you had this system of Western produce coming down and New Orleans cash as well as New Orleans cultural experiences heading back north. And remember, this would be the generation, including Lincoln, that would fight the Civil War. So at that point, I'm going to introduce you to Lincoln's, you can almost think of this as part biography and part geography and part environmental, with the Mississippi River being the unifying element. One April morning in 1865, President Abraham Lincoln gathered his cabinet to discuss matters of the day. In a moment of reflection, the president shared with colleagues his previous night's dream. Quote, he seemed to be in a singular and indescribable vessel, recalled one attendee, moving with great rapidity towards a dark and an indefinite shore, unquote. It was a recurring vision, Lincoln pointed out, and one that seemed to precede stunning news. Battles, for example, at, quote, Antietam, Gettysburg, Vicksburg. that evening he was assassinated. 37 Aprils earlier, in 1828, a teenage Abraham Lincoln floated down a singular vessel down the indefinite banks of the Mississippi River. The voyage culminated in a stunning spectacle. New Orleans, the largest city he would see for decades, the most exotic metropolis in the country, the nation's largest slave marketplace. It also exposed him to a violent and potentially murderous attack. The night before he arrived in New Orleans, he came very close to being murdered about 40 miles upriver. That trip and a second one in 1831 would form the two longest journeys of Lincoln's life, his only visits to the Deep South, and the closest he ever came to immersing himself in a foreign culture. The two voyages form key experiences in the least known era of Lincoln's otherwise thoroughly examined adult life. Perhaps the hypnotic sensation of descending that deceptively placid current through fog and mist for days and weeks instilled in the future president's slumbering mind the source imagery from which that recurring riverine dream arose. We can say with greater confidence that the two flatboat voyages to New Orleans informed Lincoln's intellectual and moral development in many ways, some likely profound, and slavery was a major one. We can say with certainty that Lincoln's journeys typified the experience of tens of thousands of Western rivermen who guided cargo down the Ohio and Mississippi during the early 19th century, and thus tell an important story about Western river commerce and New Orleans' role in it. It is also true that nearly every book ever written about Lincoln, from children's readers to scholarly tomes, recounts the Mississippi flatboat story and ascribes importance to what the man experienced in New Orleans. I won't go into the navigational hydrological details of Lincoln's trip, though I put a lot of work to try to nail down the exact time window that he was in the city so I could reconstruct what he would have experienced here. He did not leave a journal, by the way. Of Lincoln's trip down the Mississippi today, but rather I'd like to focus on the cultural role and the psychological impact that guiding a flatboat down the Mississippi to New Orleans played for young Western males 160 to 220 years ago. That is, as a rite of passage. Belgian anthropologist Arnold van Gennep's seminal work, The Rites of Passage, in 1960, identified three interconnected stages commemorated by such practices worldwide. First comes separation from the familiar world of one's youth, followed by a liminal era of transition, ordeal, and ambiguity. Finally, after the passage, the youth reincorporates into society and assumes his or her newly earned higher status. Lincoln's flatboat years map out well to Van Gennep's stages. The 1828 trip marks the initial separation, the alienation and discord of the next 3 years, where he started to have falling outs with his family. He's intellectually head and shoulders above his neighbors, and that's starting to have an impact on him. He's casting his eyes towards a larger world, represent the ambiguous transitional era, which culminates with the second trip to New Orleans in 31 and the subsequent Black Hawk War experience. Afterward, indeed, immediately upon returning from New Orleans, Lincoln reincorporates into New Salem, Illinois society with full manhood status, living alone, supporting himself, and aspiring to lead by running for office. What was interesting about the 1831 trip here, he arrives at precisely the time that one of the talk of the town was the inauguration of the very first railroad west of the Appalachians, called the Pontchartrain Railroad. And I was able to prove that he was in town at that time. It's almost unthinkable that he didn't go to the event. So he comes all the way down the river, deals with his hydrological challenges, he sees the railroad, presumably. He goes back, he runs for office. The two major things on his platform is improved navigation on Western rivers and railroads for Illinois. A related life passage phenomenon relevant to Lincoln's flatboat experience is that of the sea change. Today, this overused expression implies any significant shift in thinking caused by nearly any agency. The original expression, traceable to Shakespeare's The Tempest, who knew, suggests that sailing across open ocean profoundly transformed first-time travelers. Passengers, the theory went, forged new survival strategies, created alliances, and formulated spiritual awareness as they sailed across the threatening unknown and disembarked at their destination with new perspectives and outlooks. No doubt there is truth in the sea change. Human beings transform slightly every day, and thus it seems reasonable that a significant shift occurs over the course of a lengthy, risky, first-time transoceanic travel. But what about rivers? Travel on rivers with the visible safety of the nearby banks imparts less mystery and risk than open seas, granted. Yet Lincoln's flatboat experience arguably may be viewed as forming something of a river change, if you will. Evidence presented in the book shows that Lincoln the flatboatman saw new conditions and geographies, experienced peril, witnessed poignant spectacles, gained skills, built confidence, and came home changed. Others saw that change in Lincoln even prior to the intense microanalysis his life received after the assassination. An admiring congressman speaking in 1864 traced Lincoln's intellectual, social, and moral development to his river journeys. This is a quote. This is before his death. That trading trip on his flatboat to New Orleans was worth a whole college course, he says. The youth passed day after day down the mighty Father of Waters, saw its tributaries, and thought of the vast continent it drained, observed and took advantage of its currents and shores, conversed and traded with its people, and fought with midnight robbers, gained an enlargement of soul and intellect, a variety of information, tact and independence of character that no learned professor could have imparted. He did even the lowest duties he undertook honestly and well, yet his ever-expanding mind called him to a higher duties in life. 4 years later, an aging Horace Greeley drew a similar interpretation of the river trips as intrinsically life-changing, going so far to analogize them to a college diploma inscribed on sheepskin. Lincoln himself alluded to the role that his flatboat experiences played in personal development. According to one recollection, he referenced his river days while lecturing a group of students, explaining that, quote, the only assurance of successful navigation on the Mississippi depended on the manner in which the flatboat was initially started. Concluded Lincoln, so it is with young folks. Be sure to get started as you begin in life, and you'll make a good voyage to a happy harbor. While on the campaign trail in 1843, this would be for Congress, Lincoln cast his 1831 flatboat voyage as an authenticating, dues-paying experience, assuring his political supporters that his presently rising stature made him no less a man of the people. This is a quote from Lincoln. It would astonish the older citizens of Menard County who 12 years ago knew me a stranger, friendless, uneducated, penniless boy working on a flatboat at $10 per month to learn that I have been put down here as a candidate of pride, wealth, and aristocratic family distinction, unquote. In 1860, while speaking in New Haven on the presidential campaign, Lincoln invoked his flatboat toils as evidence of his personal passage out of the poverty of his youth, a passage, he went on to say, that could be replicated by the free black man. This is a quote from 1860. Free society is such that a poor man knows he can better his condition. He knows that there is no fixed condition of labor for his whole life. I am not ashamed to confess that 25 years ago I was a hired laborer mauling rails at work on a flatboat on the Mississippi, just what might happen to any poor man's son. I want every man to have that chance, and I believe a black man is entitled to it, in which he can better his condition, when he may look forward and hope to be a hired laborer the next year and the next, work for himself afterwards, and finally to hire men to work for him, unquote. Lincoln explicitly found inspiration in the boatman's patient ability to focus on the challenges of the moment. This is one of my favorite quotes, river quotes from Lincoln. Quote, the pilots on our western rivers steer from point to point, he remarked, setting the course for the boat no farther than they can see, unquote. In other words, plan ahead, but if you plan too far ahead, you're fooling yourself. Indeed, the notion of river travel as a metaphor for life occupied a special place in Lincoln's world, literally. On the wall of a Springfield dining room hung a framed print of the second of Thomas Cole's four famous Voyage of Life paintings. So those kind of Hudson River School painting styles that were rather mythological, the Voyage of Life, respectively titled Birth, Youth, Manhood, and Old Age. It features a robust lad departing on a gilded vessel down a lush river towards a sublime landscape of majestic mountains and celestial clouds. If you tour Lincoln's home in Springfield, that painting is on his wall to this day. I'll wrap up there. Thank you.
Good morning. If you'll let me stand, just because, not because I think I'm that important, but because I think it's important for me to be able to see your faces. And so, for that purpose, I'm up. Let me also say a word in favor of Rich's book. To me, the most fascinating thing when he was writing it, we were talking about it, was how he had to triangulate his information the way you do as a reporter. It's almost like a detective story. that this happened here, he's here, what would he have seen, what would he have known? Because, of course, there's no confession. It's not writ someplace for you to discover. So as I read the book, I'm thinking, how did he find out what I'm learning? And that's the way I feel when I read a good information report from one of you as well. Who did you talk to give you this? The other thing I have to share with you is that Davis Rogan, who some of you heard last night, taught me funk piano here in New Orleans. Completely changed whatever I did at the keyboard until he finally gave up on me. But what he plays is a unique thing, and that it's in his blood is an understatement. Let me talk a little about the river from my point of view. It's been part of my life for most of my life. 43 years ago, I was sitting in Washington, D.C., and I got a telephone call that I didn't understand. So thick was the Cajun accent. And I picked up three phrases: Mississippi River, another thing that might have been a river that went chaffa-la-la-la, I think. And the third was the ivory-billed woodpecker, and that one I knew. And so I said, I'll be on down. So I came down, and I've been here ever since. It took 17 years to save the Atchafalaya Swamp. Lawsuits, lobbying, a lot of citizen action. We made two movies, the soup to nuts. It was a political campaign. The end of which is very important to New Orleans, because when the Atchafalaya is wet, we're dry. And had the Atchafalaya been drained and dried, we'd be in a world of trouble, because that's where the big water goes. So it worked out well for all when all got a chance to finally think about it. Since then, the Mississippi River just came coming in the door. You can't live here and not be aware of this chemical complex going upriver. It's the greatest concentration of the chemical industry in America. And it all comes downriver. It comes in the water. Every glass of water you'll pull here, unless you get it bottled, will have gone through, statistically, 2 1/3 industrial processes before it reaches your lips. There's that much going in the river. One plant in Baton Rouge emits more toxins than all industry in the state of Ohio. Three emit more toxins than all industry in the state of New Jersey. I come from New Jersey. New Jersey. So there's another stunner to dedicate your life to, really. And then there's the collapsing delta. When I came here, Mark first started reporting on it, and others. This was 1971, 3, 2, 4, 8. We were losing an astonishing 8 square miles a year. Over the next 2 decades, it would rise to 45 square miles a year. And the only reason that's tailed is the industry's gone offshore, finally. And there's so much lost that, statistically, there's less to lose from. There's a tragedy out there that is unbelievable. And it's our doing. And then there were the diversions. And then there was Bayou Sauvage, the old relic Mississippi base going off to the east, where the city had a better idea, they would build an international jet port. And if we objected that building a jet port in a swamp wasn't a good idea, they would extend it then into Lake Pontchartrain, which we also thought wouldn't be a great idea. And so it went. Every one of these was a war zone. Every one of these was a reportable story. And then Lake Pontchartrain itself, America's largest interior lake, with a bed of clamshells that were the base of all life in the lake. Shelter, food, everything. And we have been dredging up the base of that lake for 50 years and about had exhausted it. And the lake was dead. That lake fed New Orleans. We got our commerce from the river. We got our food from the lake and from across the lake. And those big canals that came in, the Basin Street, the Bayou St. John, those were the feeders from the lake. It fed the city, and we killed the larvae. And that was a war. That was only 11 years. But all of these are dead stories, right? But they were a very fertile field for an environmental lawyer to land and for an environmental reporter to land. And we worked rather symbiotically, because I would get a lot of information for them, and I would give them a lot of information, and it worked well. But there were very few of us. We're the largest, least reported story in the United States. Any one of the things going on here would be headlines in another state. But they're all happening. The biggest unreported story now that I can think of nationally, not locally, is one you doubtless have attended to in your conference, and that's the Levee Board lawsuit against 97 oil and gas companies for having destroyed the marshes below this very city that have protected us from hurricanes for time immemorial. And those marshes are now gone. They've been ripped to shreds by oil and gas canals. The photographs are absolutely dispositive. They will make you weep. So the stakes are large. Will oil and gas have to pay reparations for the harm it caused? Because otherwise, we don't have the money to keep a levee system going, to say nothing of restoring the coast for fish, wildlife, and other uses. So stakes are huge. And the political stakes are huge, if you may know. By the way, have you covered this at the conference? Yes, no? No? What city have you been in?
It was covered a couple before.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, let me synopsize then. Ask Mark about it. He can give you chapter and verse. The photographs are available in his newspaper. The photographs that are available on the web, and I can give you sites. What you need is a good photographer, and then you add the lines. You don't even need the photographer. Just pull it from the web. It's really stunning. The governor has reacted with enormous hostility. The symbiosis with the oil and gas industry is just like coal in Wyoming, coal in Kentucky. I mean, it's absolutely the same dynamic. But here, it's even more lockstep. We are a company town, and the company is oil and gas, and that's Louisiana. And so this is a very steep slope. Whether this suit can remain alive, whether other suits can be brought, and most importantly, whether the oil and gas industry starts paying for the damage it's caused here, probably will determine the success of the so-called master plan. Because there's no way to pay for the so-called master plan. Right now, they're bandying about figures of $100 billion to restore the coast of Louisiana. We don't have $100 billion. Unless we get a few more BP blowouts, we're not going to have a penny. It's very important that they kick in their share. And their share is huge. Those oil and gas canals have taken out maybe 40 or 50% of all coastal harm. That's huge. I urge that story on. There are many good people to talk to. As for this panel, I just end this way. I've written three books. Two are on the Mississippi. One is about a little forgotten stretch of the Mississippi called the Batcher that probably you never heard about before you came here. But it's a no man's land between the top of the levee and the river. And part of the year it's underwater and the part of the year it's not. And that's what saves its butt, because if it were dry land all around, it'd be developed. But because it's periodically inundated, it remains wild. And what goes on down there is super wild. Not just wildlife, but art, rabbit hunts with golf clubs. I mean, you name it. It's all happening down there. And it's a it's a kind of a wildness within a city that no one really knows. When we think wildness, we think Bourbon Street, but there's another kind of wild here, and it's unregulated. And there's a beauty of its unregulation that you will recognize from your own childhoods. The idea of being free and out of doors. You can actually smoke a cigarette. You're 14, you can smoke. You can cage a beer from one of the old guys out there. You can build a raft. You can be Huck Finn. And you can find it out there. Kids are building rafts and pushing them out in the river. And of course, the rafts don't work and they come back in, but they can do it. So that book's really about this Mississippi-ness, which is historic, which is Huck Finnish, and which is found in many river systems around the United States. We just happen to have a big one. The second book, as I say, I haven't seen it yet, but this book is about rivers around the United States and up into Canada. You will know some of these rivers. And maybe if you feel even an ounce of what I feel, just the excitement of a river is something that is unmatched for me. They're magical. Can you imagine a machine that self-perpetuates and it's the rain and it evaporates and comes back down? I mean, it's the ultimate perpetual motion machine. It's beautiful. And that's what rivers are. But the third book and the book that I think you'll most learn from is a book out there called Taking Back Eden, which happens to have one of those Hudson River pages on the front, very famous, a Moran. And it's about what happened to our field, Dean and mine, environmental law, when it went abroad. And here's the funny thing. Environmental law came to the United States in 1969 and 70, and it re-altered U.S. government. Then it went to the damnedest places. It went to Japan, it went to Russia, it went to Chile, it went to Greece, and it did exactly the same thing. India, Philippines. It absolutely changed the country. And there was always one case that did it. And this is a story about those cases. So I think as a journalist, maybe that would be the one, taking the plane on the way home. But I'm not here to sell a book. I'm really here, instead, honestly, I'm really here to respond to your questions. This is a way of saying hello. Delighted you're here. And if you'd like to talk at any time, happy to do it. Thank you. Sorry, bud.
Good morning, everyone. If I stand up as well, can you hear me? Can you hear me in the back? Okay,
yeah.
Good. Thank you. Thank you for having me here today. Like Ali, I feel as though I am an interloper, being a lawyer rather than a journalist, but I'm pleased to be here, and I will be speaking about my book, Mississippi River Tragedies, A Century of Unnatural Disaster. I wrote it with my colleague and friend, Sandy Zelmer, who's a law professor at the University of Nebraska College of Law. And like Ali, Sandy and I both grew up in the floodplain of the river. Sandy grew up in Sioux City, Iowa, and so the Missouri River was important to her. Her family had a cabin in Lake Itasca, and Sandy reports that her mother used to give her baths in a barrel of Mississippi River water when she was young, when the family was camping up along the river on weekends. I grew up in St. Louis, which is at the confluence of the Mississippi River and the Missouri. Like Ali, the river bottom, the river basin, the floodplain was magic to me. It was unsettled, it still largely is. Cornfields, open, wide, flat land. I rode my bicycle there, I played with my dog Ginger. My mother would always say, "Don't come home muddy," and of course we always did. My mother taught me to drive in the floodplain because there were long straight roads but virtually no other traffic. And dare I say this in public, I went parking with my first boyfriend in the floodplain because there was no one else there. It was indeed a place of freedom where kids could get away and be kids. So the Mississippi River is an unnatural river. And we make that point in our book. And let me give you some evidence of it being unnatural. in the upper half of the river, which is loosely measured from Cairo, Illinois, spelled like the grand city of Cairo, Egypt, after which it was modeled. In the upper half of the river, there are 29 pairs of locks and dams. And the Army Corps of Engineers built these locks and dams, and it proudly refers to its handiwork as a stairway of water. Well, it was designed to promote navigation. It evened out the depth of the river. A lock is essentially a watery elevator where a boat can wait, where water pours in from above or below and equalizes the level so the boat can continue on its journey. So the Army Corps of Engineers proudly refers to its handiwork as creating a stairway of water, but this has transformed an otherwise natural flowing river into a series of slack water pools with all of the attendant environmental and other consequences. The lower half of the river is just as unnatural. And in the lower half, originally the river slowed down, flattened out, meandered on its way to the Gulf, carving a floodplain some 100 miles wide in places. And with the transformation of a 1,000-mile stretch of rivers, straitjacketed with up to 2,000 miles of levees, we have transformed the river. How do I get that math? Well, we measure on both sides of the river and along the tributaries, and we have constructed some 2,000 miles of levees along the lower half of the river. Why does this matter? Well, the levees hold in vital, vital sediments that are being flushed downstream. Those sediments, if allowed to expand laterally, make the richest floodplain in the world. It's no coincidence that the Midwestern United States is considered the breadbasket of the world. Think about how much topsoil we have in the Midwest. How many feet deep do you think it is or was originally? 1 foot? 5 feet? 10 feet? 1,000,000 feet? 130 feet of topsoil, which is enough to cover a 13-story building. And it's all the more unimaginable when you think at how slowly an inch of topsoil forms. It can take between 500 and 1,000 years to form 1 inch of topsoil. So our topsoil is indeed a national treasure that should be used to replenish the floodplains for agriculture, should be allowed to flow downstream to help build up the Louisiana Delta against the inevitable sinking from subsidence, erosion, and sea level rise. So the Mississippi from stem to stern is an unnatural river. Another piece of evidence has to do with the Chicago River. Is anybody aware of what's unnatural? What can you tell us?
Yeah. It's a canal.
And?
Flows the wrong way.
Yeah, we have reversed the flow of the Chicago River. Why? Well, Chicago was depositing its waste into the river, and it would flow inconveniently into Lake Michigan. Oops, that's where Chicago was withdrawing its drinking water, right where it was dumping its waste. So how do we solve the problem? We change the flow of the Chicago River, dredge a canal, and make it flow into the Mississippi River so that Chicago's waste can flow down to my home city of St. Louis, thank you very much, instead of going into Lake Michigan where Chicago withdraws its drinking water. And that has led to a story some of you may be covering about Asian carp that are so prolific, they are an introduced species accidentally. They knock people out of boats. They are a nuisance, a danger, and now because of the Chicago River, we've opened up this passageway for Asian carp to migrate and become not only an invasive species on the Mississippi River, but also to infiltrate the Great Lakes. So the thesis of our book is that because the Mississippi River is an unnatural river, many of the floods and hurricanes that happen on it can more appropriately be called unnatural disasters rather than natural disasters. I emphasize that with the best of intentions, as our nation tried to promote navigation and flood control, we have transformed the Mississippi River into an unnatural disaster waiting to happen. How did all of this happen? Well, our book highlights a trio of federal policies. They are federal infrastructure, federal disaster relief, federal flood insurance. Through these three well-intentioned policies, we have, you and I, as federal taxpayers, in essence, subsidized disaster. And we have lured people to danger. If after all, a place is insured, federal disaster relief comes in, there's a federal levy, it gives people a false sense of assurance that it's okay to settle in the low places along our coast. It's okay to settle in the low places along our river. So what emerged from our study is an uncanny pattern of trial and error, and we covered mostly throughout the 20th century, so that we would try one federal policy after another, and flood after flood would reveal the policies to be a recipe for disaster. We'd try something else, a recipe for disaster, we'd try something else. Let me give you just a quick overview of what this means. After a series of floods in the early 1900s, under the first policy, the 1917 Flood Control Act, Congress said, okay, it's time for the federal government to take responsibility for flood control. It was something that we saw local and state governments couldn't handle. But the federal government entered the field of flood control cautiously with levies only. The levies only policy was very interesting. The idea was if the federal government built only levees, essentially straitjacketing the river, it would channelize the river, it would concentrate its fury, the river would scour out a deeper channel, which would help promote navigation, and at the same time, when there was excess water from floods, the deeper channel, in theory, would be able to hold it. That was the levees only theory. Well, that was our trial. The error was revealed in the great 1927 flood that John Barry has written about so eloquently. And if you have not read the book Rising Tide, I urge you to read it. It's really extraordinary. Rising Tide by John Barry. So after the 1927 flood, people started to say that the levees only policy was the most monumental blunder in engineering history. Monumental blunder in engineering history. So what did we do to rectify our problem? We built more infrastructure. The Flood Control Act of 1928 authorized even more federal flood control structures. But we had learned our lesson, maybe, and that was that in addition to levees only, we now added what the Army Corps of Engineers calls floodways or spillways, which are essentially reservoirs or areas, release valves, if you will, where floodwaters can go periodically. Well, think about this. The Congress authorized the Army Corps of Engineers to do these floodways in some instances on the cheap. And that is, we envision that we'd need these floodways only periodically, so Congress authorized the Army Corps of Engineers to buy something called flowage easements. Have any of you covered flowage easements? They became very prominent after the 2011 flood. They've periodically reared their ugly heads. And this is what a flowage easement is. The federal government tells landowners, we might flood your land periodically, but we will buy the right to do so in advance. Here's your money, a one-time payment, and we'll be back once in a while and we'll flood your land. Well, as it turns out, this has happened maybe once every generation. Memories are short. That's my Midwestern accent, sharp, short. Memories are short. And periodically, a generation of farmers, landowners, are surprised when at the last minute, the Army Corps of Engineers dynamites open a place in the spillway and people are flooded out. Who's flooded out? The wealthy, the rich, the well-connected? No, of course not. It's always the poor, people of color, people who hadn't expected it. So that's an important environmental justice story, flowage easements. So we realized that didn't work, so we came up with, in 1950, the idea of federal disaster relief. And it's a response of a compassionate nation. When tragedy strikes, whether it's of our own creation or otherwise, we will pay people, we will help them. Well, that's a great response, but as you all have heard throughout this conference, throwing a lot of money at a problem after the fact is not nearly as effective as careful planning before the fact. And you can never put lives back together, and you spend a lot more money after the fact rather than having a good course of action thought about well in advance. Okay, so along comes Hurricane Betsy in 1965. Touches the coast of Florida, strikes New Orleans. It was the nation's first billion-dollar hurricane in 1965 dollars, Hurricane Betsy. So after Hurricane Betsy, we said, gosh, our structures didn't work, our disaster relief isn't going to be enough. Let's start federally subsidized flood insurance in advance. That way, instead of having all of us as federal taxpayers paying, we'll look at the people most at risk, we'll have them pay a pool of money through insurance premiums, accumulate a lot of money in advance, and then when flood strikes, we'll have money ready to help pay people who have been harmed. And the other important thing about the National Flood Insurance Program, NFIP, is that it was designed to have a quid pro quo. The federal government said, okay, we will provide federally subsidized flood insurance where the private market will not go. It's too risky. Everyone knows it's a losing proposition to insure people in some vulnerable areas. But in exchange, local governments, you have to act to protect your people. You have to enact land use regulations, building codes. You have to try and keep people out of the floodplain laterally, or at least have them raise up or harden their structures. So that was the idea. The National Flood Insurance Program started in 1968, relatively in the wake of Hurricane Betsy. Well, shortly after that, U.S. Supreme Court issued a number of opinions in an area of law that would be well worth journalistic coverage called the Regulatory Takings Doctrine. The Regulatory Takings Doctrine. And the idea is, if a landowner is restricted in what they can do with their private property because of a regulation, it's as if a taking of their property had occurred through eminent domain. So the idea is, if local and state governments, for example, aggressively regulate, landowners push back by suing for compensation. And so immediately after the 1968 Flood Control Act was passed, the Supreme Court passed these series of decisions that chilled state and local land use efforts, because state and local governments were afraid they'd have to pay if they regulated landowners in the floodplain. Well, we've seen the disasters that have happened. The 1993 flood in the Midwest, my home city of St. Louis, where the Mississippi and the Missouri come together, was flooded. Part of my childhood playground was flooded up to 10 feet deep, Chesterfield, Missouri. It came roaring back. There's now the nation's largest strip mall in the floodplain, with our federal dollars subsidizing Walmart, Target, Best Buy, Lowe's, Home Depot. Not the kind of things we need in the floodplain. We need rich, wonderful agriculture that needs to be in the floodplain where the soils are. So I have a passion here. I have an anger that prompted my writing of this book. So the 1993 flood, Hurricane Katrina in 2005, Hurricane Sandy in 2012 have bankrupted the National Flood Insurance Program, which is now some $28 billion in debt. $28 billion in debt, and Congress envisioned it to be a self-sustaining program. Okay, well, all of this would be fine if we were any better off. We're not any better off, and I commend to you a report by the NRC, the National Research Council of the National Academy of Sciences, that came out just this July, and it's called Reducing Coastal Risk on the East and Gulf Coasts. Reducing Coastal Risk on the East and Gulf Coasts. And three really astounding findings from that report are that, number one, our economic losses from floods and hurricanes continue to rise. Between 1980 and 2014, for example, our annual losses went from $1.75 billion a year to $45 billion a year. $1.75 to $45 billion a year in annual flood losses, despite all our federal expenditures from the three-pronged federal program. Second, federal funds are paying more of those bills. A good way to measure that is the number of federal presidential disaster declarations each year. From 1995 to the present time, we've gone from an average of one federal declaration a year to 10. And third, more people are moving into high hazard areas. Rather than local land use regulation and keeping people out of the floodplain, more people are living there. There's some fabulous slides with the NRC report. I urge you to take a look at it. It will give you some great information for stories. So to translate all of this, my work to your work, I offer you two insights. I know you do this already, but it's just kind of a reminder. Number one, I think framing is really, really important. To be wary of not framing things as natural disasters when in fact they are unnatural disasters. Even after the BP oil, I don't want to call it spill, conflagration, disaster, gushing, people were calling it a natural disaster. There was nothing natural about the BP oil disaster. Similarly, I urge you, when appropriate, to use the term unnatural disaster or human-made. Why does it matter? Well, if we think something is an act of God or a random strike of nature, we just throw up our hands and have a victim mentality. But one of the themes of this conference has been that we need to plan in advance. And if we realize that what we do brings danger upon ourselves, then there's more of an incentive to think carefully and to be planning rather than reactive in the expenditure of our money, time, resources, and energy. The second insight or reminder I offer to you is whenever you cover a number of modern stories, to think about how their roots are probably rooted, the policies, the underlying policies were probably forged in the Mississippi Basin during the 20th century. And so you can find some deep historical roots to lend some insights to your stories. Some of those issues might include the importance of resilience, planning rather than reacting, the issue of private property rights when people want to be paid not to engage in risky behavior, when inevitably federal funds will bail them out, stories on federal flood insurance, stories, kind of wonky stories on flowage easements have a lot of human drama behind them, stories on disaster efforts, bungled disaster efforts, see Hurricane Katrina, and the environmental justice implications, and also another wonky issue of sovereign immunity. And that is, when Congress entered the flood control business, it said, okay, Army Corps of Engineers and others, we authorize you to try and hold back the floodwaters, but if you fail, you are not going to be held liable in a lawsuit. Because after all, trying to stop all floods is kind of a losing proposition, and the federal government should not be penalized for trying to do this. So under the idea of immunity or sovereign immunity, there's this really interesting line. Congress said if the Army Corps of Engineers or the federal government is engaging in flood control and messes up, by and large, it is immune from liability under lawsuits. But if the federal government is engaging in navigation improvements and messes up, it can be sued and can be held liable. See liability for the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet failure, Mergo, Mr. Go, after Hurricane Katrina. So those are just a few of my thoughts, and thank you again for having me here today.
I'd like to thank our panelists and Christine's mention of words matter, and language matters brings another Twain quote to mind, where you guys might remember Twain once saying, the difference between the right word and the almost right word is the difference between lightning and lightning bug. So we'll open it up to questions from the audience. We'll repeat the question after you ask it for recording purposes. So if you want to raise your hand, I'll call on you and we'll get started.
I had two questions, if that's okay. I had one for Ollie and one for Christine. The first one for Ollie is, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about the master plan. And there's been other leak reports, you know, from government agencies and the Army Corps of Engineers that really, it's really inevitable that we're going to lose the wetlands. So the question I have for you is, should we really try to be rebuilding New Orleans? I mean, that's a question. And the question I have for Christine is that, you know, I interviewed Robert Villa, who I'm sure you know, Robert Villa, the great engineer, and he talked about the flood insurance program as a program of incentivizing insanity. And I thought maybe you could talk about that.
First of all, and most importantly, for those of you who would like coffee and have been sitting here patiently, it doesn't offend me at all if you get up and get coffee and come back. So please feel free. Secondly, with regard to the master plan and the future, I wrote an article I commend to you called "Can We Save New Orleans?" Question mark. I wrote it right after Katrina, and I think I was right then, and I think I'm right now. It's quite detailed. It's in the Tulane Environmental Law Journal, and my guess is circa 2007. But here are my thoughts on that. First of all, the master plan. That's a pretty narrow target to talk about. The master plan has got a strong element of bait and switch. They talk in terms of doables, and they have price tags on the doables that are totally unrealistic. So it's going to be an iterative document, and once you've bought into it, you've got a price that's going to be amazing. Secondly, the major element of the master plan is a levee system along the coast called Morganza to the Gulf. It's an absolute disaster. There is no scientist in Louisiana that's not on the state payroll that thinks anything different. They've written joint letters on it. They've written articles about it. It's a very, very bad idea. That levee system is everything that Christie was talking about, the illusion of protection. It's being built on sinking soils. It will have constant uplifts. It's coming in right now at $15 billion. That's almost one-third of all the monies we hope to get for, quote, coastal restoration, and it won't restore an acre of the coast. It will enclose 125,000 acres of coastal wetlands, which then makes them doomed. In fact, once they are enclosed, they come outside the coastal permitting program entirely by a sleight of hand. Likewise, the levees in front of them, between them and the Gulf, are doomed because they won't be receiving any of the nutrients in the sediments that otherwise would normally flow to them. So it's a two-way killer. Morganza will wipe out more wetlands than the state can hope to restore for the next 20 years. It's an absolute piece of lard. And that's one thing that's wrong with the master plan. Another is that it's optimism is borderline bogus. And the third is that the plan never mentions the cause of the collapse that's presented by oil and gas canals. It's sort of written with the oil industry in mind. And so there's this huge void in the plan. The whole harm in the plan's view is the Mississippi River levees, which levees don't account for in any way the cutoff of wetlands 50, 100 miles away. Nor do they explain the remarkable collapse of the zone after the oil and gas canals came in. The levees have been in here since 1917. We didn't start losing the zone. We didn't become a net loser till 1960-something, when the big onslaught of canals came on. And the scientific record of the density of the canals and the rapidity of their loss is jot for jot, absolutely jot for jot. So by not identifying a major cause, and they're still permitting these canals, and by not proposing any remedy to the canals, they really miss a huge part of the action. It's like taboo. It's like no-no. So it's an incomplete plan. That said, I do not go so far as to say, therefore, it's useless to save New Orleans. The plan's greatest single threat is not its inconsistencies and not its omissions, it's sea level rise. I don't think anything out there is going to be able to keep pace with the projected rate of sea level rise, particularly if that rate continues exponentially up and not linearly up. And now it's in exponential land, right? So if that continues, there's nothing on God's earth that's going to save wetlands from Texas to Mississippi that are all out there on their own. We can build little pods at enormous expense. Some of you went on the field trip. You understand the expense of building those little flats and the high intensity maintenance that's going to take. The sand island will be great until the water rises. And then that sand island doesn't rise anymore. So that's a very critically threatened environment. Needless to say, need I say, one of the greatest opponents among the states, the lead state opposing doing anything about climate change in Congress and as a state and in court, is Louisiana. It's incredible, but there it is. So hope for the zone in total, I think, is extremely hard to have. Hope for particular salience is quite possible. Given enough money, we can grow tomatoes on the moon. And given enough money, we can protect New Orleans. I, for one, and this isn't just because I live in New Orleans, I think New Orleans is worth protecting for cultural and heritage reasons that far surpass benefit costs. Even though it's full of fools. They're my fools. Davis is a fool, and he's a good friend. And Davis could not survive in most cities, and certainly not the Midwest. We have unsurvivable characters. So all of that. Rich.
I'm a fool.
But Rich couldn't thrive in another environment. I couldn't imagine it. Would have difficulty. So I think all of that is worth a hell of a lot of money. That hell of a lot of money is available, and the technology is available. You can build levee systems in series that can hold, and particularly, you can reconstruct marsh out in front. The Mississippi Gulf Outlet, one levee system that Christine mentioned in her presentation, took out 28,000 acres, 28,000 acres of cypress, tupelo gum swamp that shielded us from storms like a platoon of soldiers. They were just there. And those really knocked down wave height. They're gone. Now, if you have a moment, drive down Plaquemine and look to your left and right. You see dead sticks sticking up. They were forests. So we need to rebuild those, and that's doable. Lots of money, but it, you know, we can save the city. I don't think we can save the coast. Mark, you can correct me on that, but that's where I'm at. Okay. Mark's as much of an expert on this than I. He talks to many more people, and he has to, as a reporter, be a little more cautious than I am. Christy.
Thank you. Okay, the second part of the question is the NFIP, the National Flood Insurance Program, incentivizing insanity? Well, first I will say that I'm not so naive as to think that we cannot have some building in floodplains. All throughout civilization, great cities have grown up along water for good reason, for commerce, for trading. But having said that, we have known for a long time that the federal subsidies are dangerous. So even President Calvin Coolidge back in the 20s worried that federal subsidies would encourage wastes unless citizens had some skin in the game. Gilbert White, who's the father of floodplain management, chaired a task force. And in 1966, they said that, yeah, flood insurance, federal flood insurance might be a good idea, but if it's applied the wrong way, it can exacerbate the whole problem of flood losses. It can backfire. So the idea when the flood insurance program was enacted was that eventually through attrition, older structures would come down, be removed from the floodplain, we'd quit having new structures, and it was thought we'd only need this insurance temporarily. Well, somehow the idea of precluding new development in the floodplain did not come to fruition, so that makes the program seem like insanity. A phrase that the insurance industry knows well is that of moral hazard. And the idea is that if people are able to offload their risks, if the risks are subsidized by someone else, then they will take more risks than they would if they had to bear the harm. So the idea that really that has emerged is that the flood insurance policy program has created a moral hazard where people knowingly or unknowingly take greater risks than they probably would without the availability of that insurance.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Cynthia. Okay.
Okay. So Christine said we have transformed the Mississippi River into a natural disaster waiting to happen. And yesterday we had a great panel on covering the epic drought in California and covering water scarcity. And one of the journalists asked about perennial proposals that come up to solve the Western water crisis by diverting the Mississippi River to the west, which still gets talked about now. And so I just wondered if any of the panelists would like to comment on
you go ahead, Christy, but I got some thoughts on that too.
See that as things get really bad in the west.
Cynthia's question has to do with the allegation that the unnatural Mississippi is a natural disaster waiting to happen. And the tour and the comments yesterday from California that was proposing perhaps that the Mississippi River be diverted to supply California in its time of drought. Well, California is a case study in never having enough water. Starting back, oh gosh, in the 1920s at least, California reached north over mountains, I'm thinking of Los Angeles, trying to get more water from the Owens Valley, trying to get more water from Mono Lake. When that wasn't enough, California tried to get water from the Colorado River. Throughout time, there have been crazy schemes. Let's tow icebergs down from Alaska to supply water. Well, some of those schemes didn't contemplate that the time it took to tow the icebergs was longer than the time it took for them to melt. But never mind mathematics, right? We're dreaming big. In the 50s, there were plans to use atomic bombs to blast out canals that would allow us to divert the Mississippi River to help replenish the Ogallala Aquifer in the High Plains, and hey, while we're at it, why not California? So we always have these ideas, and in fact, I began my career as a Western water lawyer, and I was in Denver working for the state of Colorado, and I was always perplexed by the phrase, new water. Well, lawyers are notoriously non-scientific, but I remember from my science classes, I don't think they're making any new water, are they? And it's like alchemy, right? So there's some mad scientist. So really, new water in water law is absolutely accepted. We need to get new water. Well, what that really means is we need to get someone else's water or the environment's water upon which we all depend to support us, the natural systems. So yeah, California has always been looking for more water. It's been looking to the Great Lakes, to the Mississippi. Really, I think conservation is the issue, and something else we have not dared to talk about since the 1960s, but the population of the earth. That treads dangerous territory of religion, politics, personal freedom, but there's a carrying capacity to the earth, and there just isn't going to be enough water for all of us to use water in the ways that we've been using it, in the places that we've been using it. Something has to give.
I see Jay looking at his watch, but let's have Richard and Ollie comment on this, and then we'll take maybe a couple more.
Yeah, I wanted to echo what Christy said, but I don't want to go so far as population control, which for me is a universe so large that I don't want to get environmental solutions tied to that universe. I think lots of things are going to happen over the next century that will control populations in ways that we don't even appreciate at this point. It seems to me the great challenge of environmental policy, environmental law, though, is dealing with the myth of technological fixes. We're engineers, we're an engineering country, we're a can-do country, so we can fix anything. We can move the Mississippi River to California. I mean, think about that. Across the Sonoran Desert, across Death Valley, you're going to cut through Colorado Rockies. I mean, that's a fantastic proposition. That's sci-fi. But we're willing to go in sci-fi, and we throw bundles of money at sci-fi, other than dealing with the root problem, which isn't so much how many people we have, but where are they going to live? And that's exactly the question of the floodplain, and it's exactly the question of the desert. People live in the desert think they have a constitutional right to water. I mean, come on. And so it seems to me that the undealt with piece of the equation at every issue you face in this field isn't, you know, they say we have a natural resources problem. We don't have a natural resources problem. We've got a people problem. The resources are there. They're doing fine. And it seems to me that the question we're not able to broach until you broach it and raise it and ask questions about it and write articles about it and push it is, okay, Louisiana, what are you going to do in your master plan about pulling people back from the coast? Okay, New Jersey, what are you going to do about people pulling back from the next Sandy? And the answer is we're going to throw more money at the people to do exactly what they were doing. That's exactly dumb. And some of you ought to be doing that. So we need to change the mindset that we can do anything we want, live anywhere we want, do whatever the hell we want, and tech will fix it. That's wrong. Okay, enough. I'm off my wagon.
Richard. Sounds like a geographer's problem. Maybe Richard.
Oh, I think it's a geographer's problem.
less water in the lower Mississippi would have three really negative impacts on this region. For one thing, you would have less raw material to use for coastal restoration.
Sure.
That excess water diverted out would push back, in theory, the saltwater wedge. The sediment therein would be used to build the wetlands. All of that would be less in quantity if you have X amount heading west. Secondly, a slack water body reaching the lower Mississippi means more deposition in the bed load, which would require even more dredging. And we need to kick up dredging anyway because of the expansion of the Panama Canal and the post-Panamax ships coming up. Thirdly, as you know, our water source is from the top of the river, but when the river is very low, probably not where, about like 3 or 4 feet, I think, stage right now, it gets a little bit lower, a saltwater wedge creeps up at the bottom of the river. And it was just in 2012 when that red wedge reached high enough that Plaquemine Parish and I believe St. Bernard had to start buying water from New Orleans because there was salinity in the drinking water. So with less water coming down the river pushing back that wedge is going to come up farther and higher and threaten municipal tap capacity here. So it would be adding another unnatural disaster to a series of unnatural disasters.
Guess what? California didn't care. Neither does Texas, which is the real threat. That's where the river is now under most aggressive planning.
John from St. Louis, you got...
Yeah, this is for Christine. You probably know that they built two new malls in the land of the largest
exciting premier outlet mall.
Right.
Yes.
So when we write about this in newspapers, the answer from Reeves' skeptical readers is, well, they now have a 500-year levy there, so it's okay. How do you bonk that for readers that it's not really a 500-year levy?
Yeah, I guess that's the whole, again, problem of the terminology. You know, the 100-year levy, it will protect us for 100 years. The 500-year levy, it will protect us for 500 years. As the speakers yesterday said, if you look in Holland and the Netherlands, they're looking at 500-year, 1,000-year, 10,000-year protection. I think the important thing to remember is all levies fail, and they are designed to fail. They're designed only to a certain level of flooding, and after that, all bets are off. And we could have a so-called 500-year flood. Help me out with my math. That means there is a 0.2% chance of flooding every year. You could have that every year. You could have a 500-year flood this year, next year, next year. So it's translating what that means, and it's also putting it into perspective that other places, if you really want to be serious in eliminating or minimizing risk, it has to be much higher than that. And the other idea is that levees will fail. They're designed to fail at a certain level.
Yeah, let me ask you, you're all very good professionals. I've quoted Ollie in my book, Blue Frontier. I mean, you fought the good fight. You have a lot of skills. And you communicate well, and yet you've all written books at a time when fewer Americans are reading and when the publishing industry is in a state of free fall. What is the personal reason you're writing books, and what do you think you can still accomplish with writing your books?
Thank you for that. A sobering reminder of our uselessness.
We're all addicted.
One thing I find about writing of any kind is to clarify the mind. And so a lot of things I write, I don't end with the answer. I start with a problem and describing it, and I chew it, and I chew it, and I don't sleep at night, and I keep little sheets of paper in my pocket. You've got your notebooks, and I'm writing the notes, and I'm writing the notes, and I'm working through it, and I'm trying it out on other people. And so it's iterative, and I think that process is really useful. Secondly, in terms of the political game that's being played here, books have their own power. Who the hell trusts a blog? You know, who trusts what these days? Who trusts a newspaper? And so a book has a certain weight of its own. Well, it's a book, right? And so I think it may be unjust. There's a lot of bummy books out there. But I think in defense of books, they can carry their own power. People are still citing John Barry's Rising Tide around here as if it were the Bible. It got him on the levy board. And by the way, the levy board case that I was talking about was prompted by John. He was its leading, a little help from others of us, he was the lead actor on that. So he was an author turned radical by what he wrote. So I wouldn't throw it out. I'd also have to say, and this is honest, it's catharsis. After Katrina, when I wrote, can we save New Orleans? I just had to get rid of Katrina. And I tried to do it in a positive way, in a way that was constructive. Cool.
Judy, go ahead.
Good. I'll add one brief thought. I agree with Ollie that it is refining my own thoughts, and then it informs my teaching. I have a captive audience, and I am energized by my students. I can tell you, from my experience, I think our young people in their 20s are fabulous. And if I can just plant the seed in one mind every year, who knows what will happen. And so it's not something I would have done early in my career, but it's something I do now, and I hope that maybe it will bear some fruit down the road that I can't even know about right now.
Personal curiosity is my main motivation as to why the book form. Humanity has literally millennia of experience of archiving books, and I wonder, how will we be archiving all this digital data? How will your articles be referenced and cited 100 years from now? We have a fair amount of experience in archiving papers in archives as opposed to libraries for books. But I really worry, all these digital photographs we're taking, your kids' pictures, are those going to be retrievable a generation from now? So there's some solace in knowing that when it's in book form with a Library of Congress number, there is this legacy of storage that will preserve them.
Thanks, everybody. Let's give our speakers a round of applause.